Welcome to the Empire Builders Podcast, teaching business owners the not-so-secret techniques that took famous businesses from mom-and-pop to major brands. Stephen Semple is a marketing consultant, story collector, and storyteller. I'm Stephen's sidekick and business partner, Dave Young. Before we get into today's episode, a word from our sponsor, which is, well, it's us. But we're highlighting ads we've written and produced for our clients. So here's one of those.
We make orthotics. That's right, truly custom orthotics. I'm talking perfectly measured, right in my office, shoe inserts to make your feet feel good.
Ooh, that sounds nice.
You're right, Archie. Good is not good enough.
But Dr. Milky.
Nope, you can't change my mind. You deserve better than good feet. Truly custom orthotics should give you
great feet.
You know how I know you will have
great feet?
Nope.
If your new orthotics don't give you
great feet,
then I will give you a full refund. Cause I'm Dr. Milky.
Milwaukee's foot doctor.
To get your orthotics and have
great feet,
come see me at walkiefeet.com. Spell it however you'd like.
Walkie feet.
Welcome back to the Empire Builders Podcast. Dave Young here alongside Stephen Semple. And as usual, Stephen has whispered the topic into my ear as the 5-second countdown commenced. So I have, 3 seconds to come up with whatever my initial reaction to the brand is that we're going to discuss. And my recollection for this one is, let me tell you what it is first. It's Swatch. Remember the watches? And my recollection of it is they were just too damn cool for me.
And I mean, you're not a fashionista, Dave?
I never have been, but here's the thing. Like I think by the time, you'll have to fill in the dates here, but I think by the time I got out of college and was, making my way in small market radio, the point of having fashionable timepieces on your wrist, that's just too cool for me. I recognize it as a cool idea that was going to make somebody a gazillion dollars.
Yeah.
But it wasn't going to be my dollars that got it done.
Well, you're somewhat accurate and somewhat aren't, because I believe that we are around the same age. I might be a tick older, but
okay.
It was fall of 82 when Swatch was launched, but they became really big late 80s, early 90s.
So, yeah, I graduated college in 84.
Okay.
And so, by the late 80s, and remember, I was in Western Nebraska.
And there was no Amazon.
Dude, Gone with the Wind has just now arrived at theaters in Western Nebraska. When you think about the good old days, they haven't even hit Western Nebraska yet. They're still waiting. So go ahead.
Here's the thing that's, as I got looking at Swatch, here's the thing that's really remarkable about Swatch is how much they changed the watch industry.
Yeah.
It is an idea that was remarkable, because not only did it change the watch industry, it saved the Swiss watch industry.
Oh, I believe it. Yeah.
Like the change that came about was incredible. If we go back pre-Swatch, the idea of a watch is it was a single purchase item. People owned one wristwatch.
Yeah, and you decided, do you want a leather watch band or one of those metal expandy ones?
Yeah.
Which watch guy are you?
Right. And Rolex, for example, was not even a high-end luxury product at that time. It was an expensive watch, but it was not a luxury watch. It was not an aspirational one. And it's really interesting. Even if you take a look at Rolex's advertisements from the 70s versus the ones, 2000 and on, they're a very, very different feel. Like one was, it's rugged and you can use it, and they aligned with certain sports such as diving and things along that lines. You look at how it's positioned today and it's a fashion statement.
Yeah, see that.
It's very, very different. And 10 years following the launch of Swatch, is they became the largest watch brand on the planet.
Well, I'm sure we're going to hear about tons of imitators, and they hit right in that slice of time. There's a couple decades, just maybe a decade, just before everybody had a cell phone in their pocket and didn't need a watch anymore.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Because that kind of took the wind out of the sails of the watch industry for a little while.
Yes.
Okay.
So we got to go back to basically the early 80s. And Nicholas Hayek Sr. is running the group, and he was born in Beirut. He grew up in Switzerland. Here's the thing that's interesting about all of that is there's two industries in conflict at this time in Switzerland. If you take a look at the two biggest industries in Switzerland at that time was the watchmaking industry and the banking industry.
Okay.
Here's the issue. The watchmaking industry, the entire industry is in deep, deep, deep trouble. And they actually call it the quartz crisis. Because what had happened is the quartz watch came out. And basically, what was happening is the Japanese could make this electric watch that kept better time dirt cheap.
Seiko. Yeah.
Yes. And it was killing the watch industry because at the end of World War II, half of all watch sales were Swiss-made watches. And at the time, Swiss meant quality, all this other stuff. 1969 comes along. Japan enters the market with the Seiko. It's cheaper, more accurate. And guess what? The watch industry does what every other industry does. It's just a fad. It'll never catch on.
Yeah, that'll pass.
Right? By 1972, it's having such an impact that James Bond in Live and Let Die wears a Pulsar, the world's first digital watch, where before it had always been a Rolex.
Yeah.
Think about that in terms of an impact. And so, yeah, when faced with disruption, often the players in the space kind of ignore it. It's a fad. It's below us. It's going to go away. And it starts bleeding sales. By 1982, the Swiss watch industry had declined by 2/3.
Wow. That's many thirds.
Yeah.
There's only three of them.
Yeah. And basically what happens is the banks want to cut bait on the industry and sell out to the Japanese.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Like, let's just sell this industry to the Japanese. Now, it's interesting. Rolex was not part of this group that was looking to sell to the Japanese. Rolex was a different group, but this impacted Rolex as well. And what they did is they asked Hayek for a blueprint to basically get out of this problem. It's like, what are we going to do here? And instead of selling out to the Japanese, he comes up with a different plan. And this is brilliant because when faced with a low price competitor and this disruption going on, Dave, what do most people want to do?
Well, they want to do what's popular.
Right, which would be lower the price and go after that, right?
Yeah.
But he creates a different. He basically looks at the marketplace and he says, the market is split into three parts. There's the bottom, there's the middle, there's the top. And what he looked at is that the Swiss watchmakers were really pricing themselves primarily in that middle space. They were expensive, but they weren't really expensive. And they had nothing at the bottom end. So the first thing he did was dramatically increase the prices on all their watches. He at least doubled the prices on them, moved them all up into the top end.
Okay.
So, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to go up. Even though we're getting killed, even though our sales are down, we're going to increase prices. That's bold.
Sure.
That's really bold. And then what he wanted to do was create something for the low end.
Oh, I love this.
Build something new for the low end.
Because if you're already positioned as middle of the road, yeah.
When disruption happens, the players in the middle always get slaughtered. Every time we've seen it in every industry.
Yeah.
You can make money at the top end. You can make money at the bottom end. And what his plan was, we're going to do both. Now, here's the other thing that we know. Anybody who's been super successful at the low end, it's not just about having a low-priced offering. You actually have got to have something that you can manufacture at a low price.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like they could come out with a cheap mechanical Swiss watch. What they needed to do is they needed to create a Swiss version of the quartz watch.
Right.
what they found, there's something that they had been working on, which was the world's thinnest watch. They've been working on this technology for a thin watch. And to make a watch really thin, you have to make it with fewer parts. If you can make a watch with fewer parts, you're able to lower the cost of manufacturing it. And they got it to the stage where they were able to make it with 51 parts versus what the Japanese were doing. The Japanese were making the watches with 91 parts. So they were actually able to come in with even more efficient manufacturing than the Japanese.
And this is still an analog watch driven by a battery, a quartz piezoelectric device.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And in 1981, they called it the Vulgaris. And in 1981, they came up with the first prototypes. And they were this black and white with this plain black band.
Okay.
And it was kind of dull. And then what they decided to do was create ones with a whole pile of colors. Because the idea was they wanted to start making the watch a fashion accessory.
Gotcha.
That was the idea. And in 1982, they ran a test actually in a mall in Texas. They created 25 different colors and they called it a swatch. And what we don't know is whether it's swatch stands for second or whether it stands for SWIT, like your second watch or Swiss watch. We don't know the origin of that, but it was somewhere along that is what created the idea swatch. It was waterproof and the battery lasted for 3 years. And it was Swiss made. And Franz Sprecher was the guy who created this idea of the name and the idea of a second watch. The idea of a second watch was brand new.
Yeah.
Here's a second watch. You want this as your second watch. And they came up with a price point where they priced it similar to a tie. Ties at that time were selling for $40. They made it $40.
Yeah.
And started to make it a fashion idea. Look, Warby Parker did this with eyeglasses.
Yeah, who doesn't want another watch?
Warby Parker copied this idea. And sales weren't that great. They weren't that great. But what they did notice was there were customers wanting to come back to buy a second and a third watch.
There's so many.
So it didn't catch on. There was this hint that there was something to this second watch idea.
Stay tuned. We're going to wrap up this story and tell you how to apply this lesson to your business right after this.
What? Message.
What?
No. What is the message?
How?
Media.
What?
Not what, but how. How is media?
Which is first?
Message. What you have to say is first.
But I thought how was first.
No, media is second. How the message is delivered is less important than what you have to say. Your message.
So the message is key?
Yes. Oh, and you can book your free starter session on this podcast website.
Back to you, Dave. Dave.
Let's pick up our story where we left off, and trust me, you haven't missed a thing.
There were customers wanting to come back to buy a second and a third watch.
There's so many. Yeah.
So while it didn't catch on, there was this hint that there was something to this second watch idea. So in March of 83, they come up with 12 styles and they're way more colorful. Like if you look at the first bunch, they weren't really vivid. Now they leaned into, let's really make these colors and styles look like it's something cut out of a fashion magazine. They leaned more into that and they roll it out in Europe and it does great. Does great. Now, they get some advice.
The president of Bloomingdale's
says, this is a great idea, except what you need to do is you need to lean more into this idea of fashion.
Okay.
So the first brilliant move is they go high end and they go low end. Mm-hmm. They find a cheaper manufacturing process, but they don't go on price. They reposition the watch as fashion. Brilliant.
Yeah.
But the CEO of Bloomingdale's says, you're not selling this like fashion.
Because here's how fashion is sold. You come out with 20 different models and you sell it for a season. And then you come up with 20 different models and you sell it for a season. What you need to do is twice a year, launch 20 models. New collection. Fashion is collections, right? A new collection every 6 months. Act like a fashion brand.
Right.
Swatch runs with this. And the first thing they come out with in the summer of 83 is this thing called the Jellyfish, which is this transparent watch. You can look them up. They're kind of wild. They come out with 200 units, sells out right away. Boom, sold. And what happens with most companies when something sells out right away? What do they want to do?
Make more?
Make more. Swatch says, nope.
That's it.
That's it. No reissues.
So now they're in Beanie Baby territory.
They've now become a collectible. They've now created scarcity. Yeah. When you create scarcity at the low end, that is magic, man.
Sure.
Designs become exclusive. No reissues. By December of 83, 1 year after starting this idea, 1 million Swatch watches are sold. Boom.
And there's got to be people that have every one of them. Right. Or loads of them.
Right. So what does fashion brands do? Fashion brands connect themselves with subcultures that are cool, right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially when
mm-hmm.
you're getting started. The interesting thing is Red Bull learned this from these guys. 1984,
sure.
What they do is they sponsor the world's first breakdancing competition.
Of course.
Right? And then sponsored by Swatch. So they create these events and then they design watches to those events.
So they're Red Bulling before Red Bull Red Bulled.
Red Bulling before Red Bull Red. And they partner with artists and designers and sports celebrities, but in these small niche sports, mountain biking, breakdancing. And they create 140 timepieces for each one of these events. And when it's gone, it's gone.
Gone. Brilliant.
By 1983, they're doing 1 million watches. 84, 3.5 million. In 86, they triple that number again. And here's the other crazy thing. Guess what else happens in the Swiss watch making business? The top end grows as well.
Sure.
This selling of the Swatches reinvigorates
all
the
watches.
Whole Swiss watchmaking industry.
That makes sense.
Because the top end pivots also to this fashion statement, except glamorizes it, makes it mm-hmm. aspirational. Rather than your day-to-day watch, this is the watch you dream to own. This one is really and truly the fashion statement.
And this is, I'm guessing, where some of these other giant high-end watches come into the game.
So GoldenEye, remember how we lost Bond? Well, Bond uh-huh. comes back with an Omega. Now, Omega is part of the Swatch group.
Okay.
And basically, by 1993, Swatch is doing $2 billion in sales. Just
all right.
Killing it. Just absolutely killing it.
And the Swiss bankers probably happy. The
Swiss bankers are now kind of
they're on board.
Yeah. But when have we seen something that has come along that not only was this new innovative idea, but actually saved an entire industry?
That's great.
Isn't it incredible?
But, yeah.
And what I love is the boldness of this. Like this whole idea of we've got a cheap competitor coming in. So what we're going to do is we're going to dramatically increase our prices.
Mm-hmm.
Step one. Step two, we're going to find a new manufacturing technique to meet them. Step three is we're not going to compete on price. We're actually going to change what a watch stands for, and that is fashion. Step four is if we're going to do it as fashion, let's do it the way fashion industry actually works. Let's lean into it, which is collections that run and sold out and is gone.
Yeah.
And then the next thing we're going to do is we're going to make it cool by leaning into counterculture. Breakdancing, mountain biking, artists that aren't super well known, small collections, send it out there. It's a brilliant strategy and roadmap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it. I love it. And again, they were too cool for me.
Well, yeah. But isn't it interesting you started off with it being too cool and that's exactly what they were going for?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I honestly ended up with a Seiko in the 80s.
Right. Yeah. Right?
But that's it. That's as far as I was going because, right. Yeah. I love this story.
Here's the other super, super interesting thing is you ended up owning multiple watches. Like the whole idea of a Swatch is it's your second, third, fourth watch. Lots of people own many Swatches. But here's the psyche it created. Guess what then started to happen in the luxury watch brand? And this is...
People start collecting multiple luxury watches, right?
I saw a study one time. I don't know how accurate the study is, but I saw a study one time that said... When somebody owns a Rolex watch, guess on average how many Rolex watches they own.
How many?
Three.
Okay.
When we talk about marketing, it's interesting when you create this idea, how this idea bleeds. Initially, pre-1970s, you owned one watch. By the end of the Swatch era, not only were you owning multiple Swatch watches, people were owning multiple luxury watches.
Yeah.
This is how much of an impact this idea had on the space. So I just, to me, the more I looked into the Swatch story, the more fascinated I became by it.
Great story. And what a powerful lesson, right? When you're faced with like the demise of your industry, almost, to figure out how to enter it, how to take your product higher and then enter it back down at the low end.
Right. And even when you go back down the low end, don't compete on price. Do something slightly different.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, and what I loved is they looked at the fashion industry and said, how can we make a watch like a tie? You wear a different tie with every suit. Why wouldn't you wear a different watch? Right?
Mm-hmm. There were fashion collections of ties out at that same time.
Correct. Correct.
Right. So they were. It was yeah. the same kind of trend, the same idea. I love
yeah.
it.
Yeah. So it's this whole idea of look at another industry, learn from that industry. And that's what they did. They didn't learn from the watch industry. They looked at the fashion industry and mimicked that. And even initially mimicked it a little bit and then really doubled down on it. And I think, and again, that's an overarching, you know, theme of this podcast.
We've always called it in our Wizard of Ads group, business problem topology mapping.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You figure out how somebody in some other industry either has solved a problem that you're facing or is solving it.
Yeah.
And you figure out the shape of the problem, the shape of the solution, and see if you can figure out how to apply it to your situation. That's exactly yeah. what they did. They did it yeah, intentionally.
They did it intentionally and saved an entire industry.
I love this story. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for bringing Swatch to the conversation.
It may be enough that we may see Dave Young in the future wearing a Swatch.
Well, I don't know, because I'm still not cool enough to wear a Swatch. Thank you, Stephen.
Thanks, David. If you're wanting to dig a little bit deeper into the Swiss watch industry, you can go back to episode 186, where we talk about the origin of Rolex and actually take a look at how Rolex did a lot of their early advertising. I think you'd find it really interesting, especially after listening to this story.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Please share us, subscribe on your favorite podcast app, and leave us a big, fat, juicy 5-star rating and review at Apple Podcasts. And if you'd like to schedule your own 90-minute empire-building session, you can do it at empirebuildingprogram.com.